We launched A Dozen Cousins in 2019, and for those first few months, I think of any new business, you're struggling to get some credibility. You know, you want people to believe in what you're doing, you want to get some traction in the market. And luckily for us, we launched nationally at Whole Foods, and then this happened.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jenny Rudin.
And I'm Katie Demo, and we're the co-founders of Brass.
You're listening to And Then This Happened,
a podcast where we discuss the whirlwinds of entrepreneurship, the ups and downs, all the messiness in between, and what it really takes to build a business.
Katie and I are on this journey right now. We're here to get rid of the glamour, remove the sheen, and demystify the entrepreneurial experience.
That's what this show is all about. Join us for conversations with founders that have seen it all and done it all.
Whether you're building a business yourself,
aspiring to build one someday,
or just love a great story,
we're glad you're here. Welcome to
And Then This Happened. Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us for this incredible conversation with Ibrahim Basir, founder of A Dozen Cousins. Ibrahim grew up one of 10 children and was exposed to entrepreneurship early as a young child, as his father had many of his own ventures, but uniquely was able to both support his family and be very present as well. Ibrahim went to business school knowing he wanted to be an entrepreneur and follow in his father's footsteps.
What's important to know about Ibrahim is that he is unbelievably patient, super thoughtful, and he's really strategic. And so he ended up, after business school, he started his career at General Mills, which laid a really critical foundation for the launch of his own company. He started off working for brands like Gushers and Fruit by the Foot, which reminded him of his childhood and the joy and the fun that food can bring. Then he later moved on to Annie's as an Annie's mac and cheese. And this is where he was exposed to products that had more of a mission. And working at Annie's was a real crash course in management for Ibrahim. And it's definitely the place that set him up to start A Dozen Cousins.
A Dozen Cousins is a healthy, flavor-rich line of rice, beans, and broths, which I've actually tried myself and am absolutely obsessed with. And it derives all of its flavor profiles as culturally rooted in his super diverse hometown of Brooklyn, New York.
So we talked to Ibrahim a lot about his risk tolerance, which we both found super interesting because it's really atypical for most entrepreneurs. Ibrahim's risk tolerance is incredibly low. He actually started his business the same year that he had his first child. So he didn't have an option of, you know, putting it all on the line. He and his wife had to be super planful and thoughtful and strategic about how they were going to start their business. And you'll really notice that that mindset that they brought to starting the business is actually how he's been running it and growing it ever since, and has allowed him to have tons of success. And we're really excited that you guys are here for this thoughtful conversation with Ibrahim Basir. We have a lot to learn from him, so let's dive in. Ibrahim, thank you so much for joining us today. It is fabulous to be with you.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we start off the show with a little bit of an icebreaker, but it also is kind of a nice little way to get to know you a little bit better. We'd love for you to share with us your first exposure to entrepreneurship.
Yeah, so my father actually was an entrepreneur. So I'm one of 10 children. I'm the 7th out of 10. And my father really was an entrepreneur for most of his adult life. And he wanted to have full control over how he spent his time, who he spent his time with, the ability to prioritize his family, our routine. And so, like, my father used to take me to school every day. He'd take us to the park to play after school. He'd help us with our homework. Like, his schedule was very intertwined with our lives. And so that was my first introduction to entrepreneurship. And he did a number of things. He owned a grocery store at one point that was actually attached to, like, the apartment that we lived in. So it was, like, all part of the same building. He ran a small taxi fleet at one point. He had lots of little small businesses. Every few years, he'd switch it up and do something different. But I always just grew up with a real admiration for him and for, you know, what being an entrepreneur meant in terms of, like, freedom and control and kind of shaping the lifestyle that you want. So
interesting. But you didn't start your career off with your own sort of intention towards entrepreneurship.
I actually think I had the intention. I just didn't start there.
Yeah.
You know,
I always
in the back of my mind felt like one day I'd be an entrepreneur. It felt like an inevitability to me. I just didn't know at one point what the industry would be. At one point, I thought I knew the industry, but not what the business would be, and, you know, so on and so forth, until obviously, you know, it came into fruition with A Dozen Cousins. But it's always something I've aspired towards, even though I have spent many years working, you know, as an employee and at other companies.
Tell us a little bit about all those pieces and the twists and turns that led you to starting this business, and how, like, they kind of all fell into place at one point and crystallized the vision for the company.
When I got into business school, to that previous comment, I went in feeling like I want to become an entrepreneur, right? And so, like, I want to build this set of experiences and toolkits to do that. You know, so I just started going through the journeys I'm sure a lot of students do of, like, what's important to me? How do I want to spend my time, et cetera? And I kept coming back to the food industry. You know, I grew up in, as I mentioned, a really big family where food was kind of central to everything we did, whether that was just 12 people gathering around the dinner table, or, you know, us having family potlucks, or us celebrating holidays through food. Like, I always gravitated to this space. And so I kind of made the decision pretty early on in my business school career that, look, I'm going to be focused on the food industry. This is what I want to do. And so then the question became, like, where can I go to get the best training? And, you know, ultimately where I landed was, like, a big CPG company, right? I felt like if I went there, I learned how to read a financial statement. I learned how to write a creative brief, to design packaging, to develop products, to pitch retailers. Like, I felt like I'd get this really diverse range of experiences, and that actually ended up playing out, you know, over the course of, you know, I spent 5 years total at General Mills and rotated through a number of different brands that they own, from large national brands with huge budgets to small natural and organic brands with, you know, smaller budgets, but felt like I learned something at every step of the way, and it was a really great experience.
Can you tell us a little bit about the brands that you worked for there and what specifically, how they impacted your development?
Yeah, the very first brand I worked on out of business school was Gushers Fruit Roll-Up and Fruit by the Foot, which at the time was just like a dream come true. First of all, I was like a superstar amongst all my nieces and nephews because they're like, oh my goodness, this guy got Gushers at all times. and, you know, at that point, you know, I always tell people I didn't know much about, like, health and wellness, sourcing, natural and organic, all that kind of stuff wasn't that important to me, honestly. It was like, if it tastes good and it's fun to eat, I was down. And so that is one thing that I appreciated about those brands and those products. They were very centered on the idea of fun and joy. And I actually enjoyed that as a marketer, right? Like, the feeling of, like, I knew exactly what those brands stood for. As years have gone by and I spent more time on those businesses, you know, I think maybe that level of, like, sugar consumption for young kids is maybe not ideal, right? And so that part has evolved, but I think the brands themselves have a very clear point of view on the world, and it was a great introduction as a marketer to get to jump into that.
You're a dad, right, Ibrahim?
I am a father of two.
Yeah, I feel like having kids really changes your opinion of sugary foods and their impact.
Yeah, I think honestly, not only just having kids, but even myself as the journey I've gone on, like, I've always loved candy. I still eat candy probably more than I should. And it's like, it's just a bad habit, right? It's one that I wish I didn't have, right? Of, like, just having an urge so every so often for a bag of Sour Patch Kids or for some candy. Like, you know, it's better to start off young, I think, helping kids build a palate that is really centered around more natural foods, things that, you know, like, if I would love for my daughter to love fruit in the same way that I loved fruit candy. You know what I mean? Yeah. If that makes sense.
That makes a perfect sense. Totally.
The other brand that I would say was, like, really positively impactful to me was working on Annie's. And so when General Mills acquired that business, I actually got a chance to move out to California and live in Berkeley. I spent just shy of maybe 2 years working on that business on a couple of different roles, but really centered on innovation and new product development. So a lot of the expansion that Annie's did in terms of, like, new products and categories post the General Mills acquisition, you know, I had a chance to support them or lead them in some way. And so that was just a great experience, man. First of all, I worked for John Foraker, who was the longtime CEO of Annie's, and he was still the president of the National Organic Division at General Mills. And in many ways, it was kind of like an opportunity to just watch, like, a CEO class, you know what I mean? Of, like, okay, how does he run his meetings? How does he set the priorities for the company? How does he communicate the mission and vision? How does he respond to current events or challenges? You know, like, there was just so many things that I feel like I got to learn and observe. And, you know, of course, now in my own company, I, you know, have my own approach to some of those things, but it's still really cool to have that template almost where you can just kind of adjust and say, okay, I like this. I'll do this like John. And then here's some other thing where, like, hey, here's how I might approach this, or here's how this would sound in my voice. And so that was just a really invaluable experience. And I feel like the way that brand was really centered on such a clear mission around making snacks and foods for kids that's better for their bodies, better for the planet. It was just so clear and so embedded in everything they did that, you know, it inspired me ultimately with a dozen cousins to try to create a mission that could have those same type of really deep roots.
Yeah, I feel like those two examples that you gave are actually super pertinent because when I think about a dozen cousins, I really see fun and joy as essential to the brand. And I also really see just the concept of nourishment, better for your bodies, better for the planet, really. That's also coming through. So it's pretty clear how formative those two experiences were. Let's speed up a little bit. Launching your company and really what was at the heart of that. And also would kind of love you to dive in. I know you spent some time on the East Coast and the West Coast. Talk about location and sort of geography and that's impact on the brand.
Yeah, so first in terms of just the brand, how it ultimately came to be, I have been working, as I mentioned, in the food industry for about 5 years, the natural and organic segment for about 3, and like just really fell in love with the space. You know, I fell in love with this ethos of responsible business, of the idea that businesses could have a positive impact on society, communities, that it didn't just have to be about money. And so, you know, I was locked in. And, you know, the only challenge that I kept bumping up against was like, man, so many of these brands that I love, they don't feel like they represent me in terms of the foods and the flavors that I grew up eating. You know what I mean? Although I loved maybe the ingredients they were using or I loved what the brand stood for, I didn't always feel like they were speaking to me from like a cultural perspective or as a consumer. And I think of culture as so interwoven in food for me personally and for, you know, my family. And so really the whole goal with A Dozen Cousins was to try to create a brand that brought together these two worlds that I was living in. One was like this really culturally rooted, family first, flavors, the idea of food. And then the other world was good sourcing, you know, forward leading innovation, you know, natural organic ethos. And so A Dozen Cousins was kind of born out of that duality. And so we launched with a line of ready to eat beans. They're all fully cooked and seasoned, made with real vegetables and spices. You know, we chose beans as our first product because they do combine taste, health, and culture in a really unique way, right? They're high in protein, they're high in fiber, but they also taste really good. And, you know, there's this emotional connection between a lot of like Creole, Caribbean, and Latin American foods and the bean, right? Since then, we've expanded into the rice category and into the seasoning sauce category, but all still anchored on that same initial insight of like, could you create products that are super convenient, taste good, and are also healthy. In terms of location, I think location is really important. COVID, of course, has like probably shaken this up a little bit, right? If you asked me this question 2 years ago versus today. With that said, I am still a believer that like cities have a personality and they have a culture, right? And so like when I look at A Dozen Cousins, I still think of Brooklyn in many ways, which is where I grew up, right? In terms of this, you know, very diverse, very culturally forward place that shaped my personality in many ways and shaped, I think, the, you know, my palate. We're now based in LA, so kind of other side of the country, which I think there's many similarities in terms of that cultural diversity and the food scenes. But I also think LA has a little bit of a connection to the outdoors and to nature maybe that I never felt on the East Coast, you know, having lived now in both the Bay and in Los Angeles. I think I spent way more time just outside at parks, at the beach than I used to when I was in New York. And so I don't know if that gets at your question, but I do feel like both of those things help influence our brand now, right? Where we kind of live between this world of like urban culture and but also like just outdoor wellness, you know, healthy eating type of energy.
Precisely. I think it really resonates and comes through with the company. I'd also love to hear a little bit about like the timing in your life when you started this company. How did you take that leap officially? And what else is going on in your world that sort of either motivated you to do it at the time or made you hesitant at the time? Give us the run up to the launch.
Yeah, so in terms of just the nuts and bolts of it, I started A Dozen Cousins after having spent 5 years, you know, at a large CPG company, which we talked about. And when my daughter was 2 months old, so my eldest daughter had kind of just been born. And, you know, the timing for me was really predicated on just like one or two things. Like, number one, I had always said to myself, once you have an idea that you believe in, and you think you have the skill set to really bring it to life, then you should just do it, right? Because my whole life, I feel like I've been hearing stories of like people who wanted to be entrepreneurs or who had an idea, but they sat on it or they didn't do it or their family prevented them or like, you know, just a number of like just things that stop people from launching a business once they got going in life. And kind of, I just made the commitment to myself that I wouldn't let that happen. And so, you know, I always took off the table this idea of like, I'll wait till my daughter is a little older, or I'll wait until I have a certain amount of money in the bank, or like, you know, all these things that could just naturally slow you down and have you waiting for some point in the future. I was just like, look, I have an idea, you know, which I kind of articulated to you guys of like the early idea of a dozen cousins. I felt like I've been doing this for 5 years. At that point, I had launched maybe 12 new items across, you know, four or five different brands. I'm like, clearly I know how to do this, right? And so why not just dive in? And so I dived in and, you know, my wife and I, we laid out a plan in terms of what it would mean in terms of like our budget and, you know, how much time we'd give ourselves to explore this before, you know, we needed to see some traction. And we just kind of created some guardrails and milestones to make it feel less intimidating and less daunting. And, you know, thankfully we've been, you know, been able to kind of walk that path.
Can we dig into that a little bit more? Because when we first spoke, I was really struck by the sort of non-negotiables that you laid out for yourself, where you were like, I'm a new dad, I have a family, I am not going to bet the house on this. I'm not going to take that immense amount of risk. And I think that some entrepreneurs feel like that's the only way, is to like take all of this crazy risk. And I feel like you really figured out a way to find some balance. And there's just so much for people to learn from that.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that. I'm happy to share a few bullets. You know, for us, number one was I've had outside investors in our business really from day one. And in some ways, I realized that is a luxury and a privilege of having worked in the food industry, and that I had a good network of people to pull from for angel investment or for, you know, friends and family investment, however you want to think about those very early dollars that went into the business. But basically, to your point, I was like, look, I'm not going to put my entire savings and have a 2-month-old and my wife wants to stay home and enjoy those early years of our daughter's life. And like, you know, I wasn't willing to sacrifice all those things for the business. And so that was one thing that we did. It was just brought in, and it wasn't a ton of money, but it was enough to just lighten that load a little bit, right? The second thing we did was we just created a timeline. And, you know, the early timeline was I had 1 year that I could go without drawing a salary, right? By the end of like 1 year, the business needed to be able to pay me something so that, you know, we could pay our rent and food and what have you. And then, you know, I had given ourselves 2 years to get to a point where we had meaningful traction and like a more comfortable salary, a really livable salary. And the goal there was just to say like, look, if this isn't working, we want to cut it off. You know, we want to have a period where we know to cut it off, again, without jeopardizing kind of our family's finances. And, you know, thankfully we're able to hit those two milestones. You know, after 12 months, I took a very, very small salary. I think literally it was enough to like pay our rent and like cook dinner every day at home. And, you know, after 2 years, we were able to bump that up a little bit to, you know, something I would consider more of like a livable wage, if you will. And then thankfully, you know, from there, we've been able to just grow the business and continue on in kind of a, you know, a normal path.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I think it's very powerful for people to hear that there's more than one way to start a business from a financial standpoint.
I don't think you ever need to be like betting the business on stuff. Like I hear people talk about this all the time of like, to me as a leader, I'm being successful if we never have make or break moments as a business, right? Or that we have as few of them as possible. And so it's like, how do you manage risk? How do you right size decisions so that if it goes poorly, you still get to like live to fight another day? You know, like we don't ever want to be in these back against the wall, company died because I flipped a coin type of situations. So we, you know, we try to avoid that stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like thinking five steps ahead a little bit, Ibrahim. I recall us talking before about how every single thing you do each day, every investment you make in some sort of strategic initiative, whether it be growth or expanding into a new product or whatever it may be, are you actually taking a step forward with every investment into the company? Like you treat money like a tool. You said those words. And this has always been like a controlled experiment as a result of that. I feel like there's a security that you create both for yourself as a leader, but probably for your team too.
I hope so. You know, I appreciate you saying that. And yeah, I do 100% think of capital as a tool. I think of like, is it moving us forward? Is there a positive ROI to it? Is it better than something else we could be doing with that money, right? Like I do try to think that way because in an early stage venture, you know, cash is very valuable, right? And so it's like, you don't want to be in a position where you're just squandering it or spending it really loosely. So we treat it with care. If anything, I now feel like I need to push myself to be a little more risky, right? Like not too much, but a little bit more. But I do think that we've created hopefully a feeling of security for the people who are in the company.
Can you talk about that a little bit more? I would love to hear more about pushing yourself from a risk perspective.
Well, at the end of the day, there's always a tension between growth and profitability, right? Or growth and risk aversion. You know, like there is a tension there, right? At the end of the day, I'm not actually optimizing for the safest path, right? Because if I was, I wouldn't have started a company in the first place. I would have just continue growing my salary as an employee. That actually was that's the safest thing to do, right? So I say that to say, I do want to acknowledge that there's a need for some healthy risk, right? And so like, as the company grows, it's just a question of really making sure that you pick the right spot of healthiness, right? Like there's times, for example, and I won't mention specifics, but like retailers where we launched in one city where if I could go back, maybe I would have launched in the whole country, right? Or, you know, maybe we started in a really small experiment or a region and I would have gone bigger if I could go back. Just because, you know, I did, like I said, I had that bias of making sure that if we failed, it wouldn't be crippling to the company. But, you know, I think we've gotten better over time at finding, okay, when do you swing a little harder? What's a good risk to take? Still never betting the company, but definitely trying to get a little riskier as the business requires it.
Ibrahim, I'm curious about some, like, as you reflect back on the beginnings of A Dozen Cousins, what are some things you wish you could tell your younger self, your early founder days? What are some learnings that you've had that you might wish you could have applied sooner?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I'll share with you just kind of if I put myself back in my shoes at that time, what were the biggest challenges or the hardest things that I dealt with, right? So one of them was just making the adjustment from working at a big company to working at a small company, if I'm being honest, right? Like when you're at a large, you know, multi-billion dollar company, most of the people who you talk to on any given day, like you're one of their priorities, right? So, you know, whether it's a supplier or a retailer or whatever, like you have their full attention and they're engaged in trying to figure something out. And that's not the case when you enter a small company, right? Like to me, a win in those early days was sometimes just getting a buyer to respond to my email, right? Or being willing to accept samples where, again, in my past life, that was a foregone conclusion, right? If we were launching something new, they would get samples. We would have a 2-hour meeting in their office, you know, go out to lunch afterwards. Like there was all that. And you have to adjust. I had to adjust to like, you can only eat what you kill, right? You got to kind of go out and get it. Like stuff's not going to just be presented to you. Opportunities aren't going to just be handed to you. So that was one big adjustment. You know, hopefully I think I was able to make that. The second thing I'll say has been like just general stress management, mood control, however you want to think about it, right? I think the combination of, you know, being a father with young children, but also, you know, leading this very early stage business, like there's just lots of ups and downs. There's lots of very stressful days. You know, I've had to build a routine. First of all, I've had to build a mindset, right, of like, how do you consistently keep an even keel, right? Don't get too excited about things that seem like they might be working until they're like, don't count your eggs before they hatch. And then on the flip side, like, don't dwell on mistakes or shortcomings. And so that's one thing. And then I think I built a routine with my wife where, you know, our home life, it leaves room for the business. It leaves room for our relationship as husband and wife. It leaves room for us, our relationship as parents, right? Like just kind of carving out time and space for all those different aspects of things.
That is so thoughtful of you, how like carefully you've considered the environment that you're creating at home and how the business can really have an impact on your home. And sometimes, myself included, like I've definitely brought things home from the office before and regretted it, you know, and really have been like, ooh, I wish that I hadn't done that. And it sounds to me like you recognized like immediately sort of like the quote unquote danger of doing that and figured out a way how to combat it. Is that just in your nature to like know how to do stuff like that?
Well, first of all, you're getting the benefit of like 3 years of retrospect/hindsight, right?
Okay, so
there's a little more trial and error than maybe you got in the initial answer, right?
Okay. You made it sound very easy,
yeah, no,
Ibrahim.
I wouldn't say it was easy, but I will say I'm a naturally introspective person. So like I make mistakes like everyone else, but my goal is not to make the same mistake 3, 4, 5 times in a row. You know what I mean? And so if it's like, okay, I see what we continue to argue about, let's sit down and try to figure out what's the root cause of this and how do we avoid it? You know what I mean? So it wasn't super smooth, but we managed it for sure.
I think the fact that you even can cite it as a priority and something that's at the forefront of your mind sets you apart from most people, you know? Like, it's so easy to let this stuff get swept under the rug and shoved into a corner and not kind of keep it front of mind and keep it important. I'm sure your employees really feel that as well. And if you're setting that example as the founder, everyone who's working on your team, they reap the benefit of that too in their own lives, I think.
I hope they would say that. If you're out there listening, team, send me an anonymous submission. Tell me if you agree with this.
Ibrahim, this seems like a nice place to segue into a philosophy of yours that has really resonated with me. I read a little bit about it in another interview you did about cultivating a strong internal voice. When I read those words, they really resonated with me. And I'd love for you to tell us a little bit more about what that means to you and how it's impacted your role as a leader.
Yeah, you know, I'll start by saying I've never had a good idea that somebody I trust didn't disagree with, if that makes sense, right? So it's like from the idea to start A Dozen Cousins to ideas that I had in my old job, like they'd always be met with some external resistance. You know what I mean? Like that's just kind of part of life, is like not everyone is going to see or understand your ideas in the same way that you do. And I think when I was younger, I would sometimes let that deter me, right? Where it was like, okay, let me change this idea and see if I can get this person on board, or let me throw that idea away. Maybe it's not a good idea. And I think as I've gotten older and just gotten more experience, I realized like, okay, no, it's okay to hear people's feedback and try to listen to it objectively, but you also have to have a little bit of like protectiveness over your own thoughts and your own ideas, because that's what makes them special. You know, it's like you have some insight or some perspective on the world that not everyone else has. And so, you know, when I said that quote that you're referencing, that's what I was referring to, right? It's like, how do you get to a point where you can just trust yourself and say, okay, this is something I actually think is a good idea. Let me push it forward a few steps so that we can test it out and see if it's good or not. And again, it's always a fine balance of like, you don't want to become, I think, so stubborn that you can't hear feedback or that you can't see when something isn't working, but you want to be stubborn enough to get it out into the world, you know? And just that act of like doing it sometimes takes a little bit of stubbornness. So hopefully that makes sense.
Totally makes sense. I also think it's probably one of those skills and sort of like tenets that you only have been able to develop because you've had sort of a lot of reps coming up with these ideas, getting negative reactions. And then the next time it happens, you're a little more wary of the resistance being valuable, perhaps, but not necessarily enough to completely negate the idea or send you down another path. And those experiences are additive, you know, and by the end, you're kind of able to take in the aspects of the reaction that you want to listen to or pay attention to, but also, you know, file it away and perhaps proceed confidently regardless.
For sure. And you also start to understand that not all feedback is the same, right? Like some feedback is coming from other people's fear, like their own internal things, right? And some things are coming from a fact that they've seen out in the marketplace, or, you know, something is coming from their own personal taste, right? And like all those things, they belong in like different buckets, you know, and you have to think about them accordingly. Like your taste might not matter if this product is not for you, you know, or your experience might be different because it was 20 years ago and the world has changed since then in this meaningful way. So sometimes I get feedback that's relevant, modern, based on current information. And I say, oh, you know what? You might be right. Let me think about this for a second. And so, you know, try to think about things in that way.
Ibrahim, I'm curious if you could share with us an experience with A Dozen Cousins as a founder over the past few years that was just like a really pivotal moment in the trajectory and the growth of the company. Maybe it was a major roadblock you ran up against, or a cash flow challenge, or what have been some of the more challenging aspects of running this company, and how did you get through that time?
Things that jump out to me immediately would be like the early days of COVID. So if you think about that kind of, I don't know, let's just call it February through May of 2020, right? Where it was still really high uncertainty. Like nobody knew what was going to happen, right? Everyone had hit pause. We were actually raising a round of capital at that time. We had a lot of people who just, you know, walked away from the table. We thought we were pretty close to getting, you know, doing an investment with them, and, you know, they wanted to pause because of kind of COVID uncertainty, if you will. And, you know, it's a scary time in the early days, but it also forced me to just, we looked at the business kind of from top to bottom, right? So we went back and looked at every contract we had. Is this a contract we want to be in? Is this a contract that we need to renegotiate? Is this an expense that we want to spend? What if this lasts longer than we think it might? What if this is worse than we think it will be? Like, we kind of went through a lot of like scenario planning and business review, like even our demand planning process, right? Of like how we forecasting volume, what does our inventory look like? Things that I think we were a much smaller company pre-COVID, and so we didn't have to be quite as disciplined about then. And so that kind of 90-day period was a little bit of like business boot camp for us. And obviously, as we know, you know, that period ended up being in many ways a net positive for a lot of packaged food brands, you know, us included, of just like people were eating more at home and a lot of dollars were flowing from the restaurant back into the supermarket. And so COVID ended up being, you know, a net positive for our business. But in that first 90-day period, there wasn't obvious that that was going to be the case. And it was a lot of like tightening up that we had to do at that time. So that's the first one that comes to my mind in terms of like really kind of challenging periods for the company. we deal with challenges every day and every week on the business, right? And like of different sizes and scales, right? Whether that is being out of stock or dealing with co-packer changes. There's things that come up. It's just, I don't know. I try to look things from a positive perspective, right? Of like, okay, if we're still in business and we're still growing, then it means that we manage that challenge.
You built this business with intention. It seems to me like your experience in CPG must have put a very strong head on your shoulders too.
I think it gave me a lot of perspective, some in the spirit of just pure experience, like you've alluded to, which I'm very grateful for, of like, okay, here's what a packaging design brief should look like. Here's how you give feedback to a designer. Here's how you pitch a retailer. Here's the questions they're probably going to ask you, right? Like, to your point, if you've done that four or five times, you kind of know what to expect. What I'd also say, though, is I dealt with so many fire drills and so many catastrophic seeming things. I worked on a business one time that was facing almost $1 million write-off because of overproduction, right? We had just tons of inventory. And so my point being, I've worked in billion-dollar corporations where stuff is going wrong every day. And so I have perspective to say, like, this is probably not the end of the world. Stuff is going to happen on our much smaller business. And so as bad as that sounds, I do feel like I've gotten desensitized a little bit to fire drills and things of that nature, just because I'm like, okay, let's try to kind of rationally look at this. And, you know, we know they're expected to a certain extent.
I actually feel like that perspective has been incredibly useful to you. And I actually think your experience on the corporate side of CPG and the fact that you were able to kind of like really be under the hood with those businesses was an experience that a lot of people who move from the corporate workplace to an entrepreneurial one don't have. Because I remember when I worked as an in-house designer for a lot of brands prior to launching my own company, which I ran before joining Brass, and I was very much kept away from that part of the business. I think we all, as employees in the big company, were aware when things weren't going well or there was some sort of major issue going on, but we were largely kept in the dark on the creative side of things, at least. Felt very sequestered away. And so I think that's actually made me, up until this point, and I think I'm finally sort of getting over like my sort of high level reactiveness to problems at this point in my career. But early on in my entrepreneurial journey, I would have very nervous and sort of extreme reactions to difficulties because I felt like I had never gone through something like that before. But having started yours with some of that experience under your belt ultimately was really useful to you, I think.
For sure. For sure. And I didn't enjoy them at the time when I was living through them. But I do think that, you know, you almost it resets your adrenaline monitor a little bit, right, in your body. So
correct.
Yeah.
Can you describe a moment where you felt like the business was taking off and you felt like, okay, now I'm seeing the traction that I want to see?
Number one was our national launch at Whole Foods. So this is like mid-2019. For the first 6 months of the business, we were just sold on Amazon. We're trying to get a retailer phone call wherever we can. Like, you know, just really like boots on the ground. Like, hey, what's up? Can I send you some samples? And when we launched nationally at Whole Foods, it gave the business a level of credibility that couldn't have been replaced otherwise. You know what I mean? Like, you can't, it's hard to just pitch someone into believing it versus, hey, we're now at Whole Foods, right? Largest natural retailer, has us in all their stores. They believe in us. You should too. And I could feel the change in momentum at that point, whether it was dealing with investors, potential service providers, other retailers. Like, that was a big step change for us. Second one was kind of that 2020 COVID year when like online sales on Amazon grew by like 7x. You know, we went from just barely selling product online, if you will, to like being the number one item in our category, you know, in terms of canned beans on Amazon today, which we still are. So that was like another just kind of step change, if you will, in the business. And then the third one I would say has been building out the team. So for like the first 2 years of the business, I was like one man band. It was just me and like an army of contractors and agencies and what have you. And at the start of 2021, we brought in our first, you know, five full-time employees. And then it felt like a real company.
I feel like we could have a nice chat for a lot longer, Ibrahim. But yes, as we are nearing the end of our time, we just want to say thank you so much for joining us here. It's been such a pleasure. And we're excited to see where you take A Dozen Cousins next.
Thank you very much, man. That was a great conversation. I appreciated the questions, and I look forward to seeing this whenever it goes live.
Hey, we hope you're enjoying the show. We want to take a quick moment to thank our episode sponsor, Stamped.
The Klaviyo and Stamped integration enables brands like A Dozen Cousins to collect and showcase product reviews with sophisticated segmentation and branding that feels like you. so you can build trust and give your customers a voice.
Learn more at stamped.io. Now let's get back to the conversation.
Thanks for being here, everyone, for this conversation with Ibrahim. Katie, truly, I don't think I know many entrepreneurs that have been so successful at setting boundaries and operating within certain guardrails as Ibrahim has. We obviously underscored this in the intro and we touched on it in the conversation, but it's truly remarkable how he, in partnership with his wife, were able to set just like a really solid, crystallized plan about the trajectory that this company needed to go in and how intent they were on hitting certain milestones at the 12-month mark and at the 2-year mark in order to be sure that he could continue to support his new family and actually build a business that could support employees and et cetera.
And Ibrahim is, I don't want to use the word lucky because he worked really hard at it, but Ibrahim is lucky in the sense that he was actually able to hit his milestones that he had put in place for himself. But there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there who might actually not hit their milestones, but come close and not necessarily wind something down. Like they kind of like prioritize that little voice in the back of their head that's saying, no, there's something here. There's something to keep working towards and really not staying within their boundaries that they had set for themselves. I feel like most entrepreneurs would probably keep going even if they hadn't hit their 12-month goals. And Ibrahim was very honest about the fact that he was just going to walk away from the business if it wasn't going to work. I respect that greatly.
He has such a grounding presence and such a comforting sort of centering effect on me. And it's just so nice to come across entrepreneurs who have a mentality that is a little slower and more thoughtful than kind of the go, 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 constantly sort of like aggressively pushing forward attitude that you see a lot of founders embody, kind of taking a deep breath, being really introspective, and using that calming way of conducting yourself to drive strategic, thoughtful growth, I actually think is really at the backbone of his success. It's so important to not plow forward at all costs and to really pause and reflect on what's happened before and how that might set you up for success in terms of what you're doing next with your company. And I was really impressed that Ibrahim was able to sort of possess that. And I hope to take a kernel of that page from his book in terms of how I think about business too. I think a lot of people will be able to do the same.
Couldn't agree more. We all need to slow down, have a little natural introspection. We are so grateful that you guys were here today to join our conversation with Ibrahim, the founder of A Dozen Cousins. Ibrahim, thank you for being with us. We loved hearing your story, and we're excited to see what you do next.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of And Then This Happened.
To hear more episodes, go to klaviyo.com/podcast to explore the archive.
And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.
For everything that happens between now and next time,
good luck. We're with you and we know you'll figure it out.
And Then This Happened is a Hit Start Media production co-created with Klaviyo. Klaviyo is a unified customer platform for email, SMS, and more that empowers online brands to own their data and grow on their own terms.
We're your hosts and producers, Katie Demo and Jenny Rudin. Hit Start Media co-founder Theo Miller is creative director. Audio production is done by Nick Canepa and Matthew Suzuki, with production management by Olivia Laurie.
Thanks again for listening.